I would like to begin with an excerpt of a poem. Come away, O human. Ow. That didn't actually hurt. Human child, to the waters and the wilds, with the fairy hand in hand, for the world's more full of weeping than you can understand. W.B. Yeats. So now that we've set a pretentious tone for the podcast today, and the pretension being that I know poetry, what I'd like to know, what's really important, is have I impressed my guest? A one-word answer, please.
Yes.
Oh! I was surprised. All right, well, with that, this is Memory Static, a podcast where we dig up the movies that we watched when we were children and all the memories associated with them and talk about them and then throw a party to watch them. And my guest today is... Oh, I am Bailey Moore. And my guest today is Wilson Smith, who is a film enthusiast and has known about the podcast and wanted to be a part of the podcast for a while. So I'm really glad that you're here. And he's produced a film that won an Independent Spirit Award and the Grand Jury Prize at South by Southwest and worked on set with Terrence Malick and Michael Bay. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor.
I'm so excited. Before we get to what we're watching tonight, I wanted to ask you some questions about when you were little. Mm-hmm. Did you have any toys that you were afraid of?
Yeah. So there was a toy in particular that really did a number on me. I'm not sure why anyone would buy it for their kids. And it was called Teddy Ruxpin.
Teddy Ruxpin, yeah, yes.
Teddy Ruxpin was sort of this nightmarish animatronic bear that had a cassette player. I don't know how much I can trust my memory here because I think you put the cassettes like in his ass, but
that sounds right.
Okay, but he would play. He would read to you. And his mouth would move and his eyes would go side to side mm-hmm. in the most unnatural, like horrific, like, you know, beta version of like, it's a small world puppet that you've ever seen. And sometimes it'd break down or like the eyelids would flutter unnaturally, like all these little like synapses were misfiring in its head. And it was just this sort of creepy, like as soon as the batteries ran out, like it just sort of sat in a corner and I kept expecting it to like... you'd come in the room and it's like, well, you know, I haven't used that in a while. There's no batteries in it, but you're still kind of half thinking that it's going to
talk on its own.
Yeah. Like say hello to you or start reading you a weird story or that its eyelids will flutter again.
Do you remember what kind of stories that it read?
No, I don't. I'm sure it was just whatever typical, like, you know, a ripoff of Aesop's Fables or Mother Goose or some nonsense like that.
Yeah, I can't really remember either. I know I didn't have a Teddy Ruxpin, but I think some of my cousins might have, and I don't know if they ever had batteries. They must have, because I seem to remember it talking and moving, and I was so disturbed by it. I didn't really want to play with it. But it's funny that you bring it up, because I was actually looking up creepy dolls on the internet, which kind of, it was a little bit of a black hole that I fell into for a while, because there are a lot of people trying to scare people with dolls and it's just really bad. But I found at the top of several lists is this doll called a Chatty Cathy doll. You ever heard one of those?
I have heard of it, yes. By reputation.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So yes. So, the Chatty Cathy doll was a doll I think that started in the '50s and went into the '60s. And my mom had one and she still has it.
Oh, God.
And so like, this is the only toy I remember really being afraid of, but it was a Chatty Cathy doll and you put little records. This was before cassette tapes. So they had the tiny little records that you put into the back of her and she was a pull string. And you know, like kids will make things up cause they like to get spooked. But, we felt like every time we pulled her string and she said something like, let's have tea, her head would wobble and it would stop, pointed at the person who pulled the string. And so it felt like, she's like, oh, you pulled my string, so I'm talking to you. And we were so afraid of it. And my mom put it up on the top shelf in my sister's closet. but I found this interesting little tidbit. The person that did all of the lines for the Chatty Cathy doll also did all the lines for Talking Tina on the Twilight Zone episode about the living doll.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that weird? Gosh,
yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, that, what a great get for Twilight Zone. Just like, we should get someone like the Chatty Cathy. Like, actually, why don't we just get Chatty Cathy?
And I don't know what came first, but I think it's really strange. I bet she did Chatty Cathy.
Wouldn't
first.
That be a nightmare though? If you're like, it's like you, if it was the other way around, and it's like Twilight Zone, like, I don't know, like a toy executive watches the Twilight Zone, and it's like, hey, that nightmarish doll, we could just make it like a couple of percentage points less nightmarish and sell it en masse.
Yeah. Someone was just like, well, this is creepy. Like, I bet this can be done.
Kids love creepy things.
So, you know, all this is, you know, loosely connected to the movie we're watching. But, you know, there is something in it that, or at least a few characters in it maybe, that are not alive in the way we think of being alive. But they constantly have to assert themselves as not being a toy.
Mm-hmm.
So what movie are we going to watch?
We are going to watch Steven Spielberg's 2001 science fiction opus, AI, Artificial Intelligence.
Yeah. Exciting.
Yes, very much so.
So why did you choose this movie?
So I chose it because, well, for a couple of different reasons. You know, when I was thinking about sort of the concept of this podcast and sort of thinking on movies that, you know, maybe ones I hadn't given a lot of thought to or enough thought to, like, in the intervening years since I'd seen them, and sort of were due for a revisit. And one that really stuck out to me was this one, because I was 12. So, like, you know, kind of like on the cusp of being, you know, a kid or whatever, but I still, my thinking was still very immature when I saw this movie. And it was marketed, you know, it's a Steven Spielberg movie. Every one of his is sort of movies is sort of an event. And this one, you know, it's like, oh, it's a big science fiction movie starring, you know, the, I believe, Academy Award nominated Haley Joel Osment.
Yes, that's right.
And it's like, oh my gosh, it's, you know, just super star packed. Like, this is going to be like the biggest movie of the year. And as a kid, you know, even before knowing who directors were, by and large, it's like, of course, you knew who Steven Spielberg was. And so I am very excited for, you know, sort of sci-fi thrilling adventure tale. Mm-hmm. And I saw it the day that it opened, and in, I think, July of 2001. And it, I really, really disliked it. I remember walking out and telling my mom and my sister, who also went with me, that, you know, that I hated it. And I, you know, I thought that it was just dark and depressing and sort of kind of muddled and like just, I couldn't really feel my way into what the movie was about or what it was trying to do. And so I sort of just, it felt like it was a failure at being the thing I wanted it to be or it expected mm-hmm. it to be. And so it's definitely a problem of expectation. And then in the intervening years, talking to people about it, fellow film enthusiasts, you know, I would hear a lot and then chatter online, people saying like, oh, AI is mad underrated and it's actually maybe, you know, I've heard it called Spielberg's best film. I think at least one fairly prominent critic on his Sight and Sound, like top 10 of all time poll, included AI as one of his favorite films. And so, yeah, and that definitely sort of sparked my, you know, interest in revisiting this movie. And also another reason is because we'll get into this, sure, I'm sure, much more later, but the film, you know, came about because of Stanley Kubrick. Stanley Kubrick initially wanted to direct this story and had talked about it for, forever with Steven Spielberg. And his death in 1999, you know, sort of obviously meant he couldn't make it. And so Spielberg sort of pushed everything in his schedule so he could sort of pay his tribute to Stanley Kubrick and finish this work that they mm-hmm. had done together. And the reason that, you know, matters or, it, you know, intrigues me now is because, Spielberg's most recent film, Ready Player One, features a, let's say controversial shout out to his old friend, Stanley Kubrick.
And what is that?
Well, there's a,
I saw the movie, but I
so it's the moment in the film in which the characters go into the movie, The Shining.
Okay. Like
the,
yeah.
And, mm-hmm. You know, the,
oh, right. Of course.
And so that. You know, it was it, people, the way people took it, and I'm sure the way Spielberg intended it was as like this kind of crazy, over the top, loving tribute to his former friend. And I have to admit, it's, I did not find that, you know, shout out amusing at all. It felt a little bit almost disrespectful, or, you know, turning someone's work of art into a literal video game. And so it made me curious as to, you know, thinking about like, well, you know, the in the realm of Steven Spielberg paying tribute to Stanley Kubrick.
You feel like there might have been a very, very like prominent misunderstanding of Stanley Kubrick and his work.
Yes, indeed. At least, so it's, you know, so it made me curious, like, well, is that, do I feel that he misinterpreted or, you know, was the wrong guy to, you know, maybe just like, Two great flavors that don't taste great together, sort of thing. Like, is this just not a compatible match? Does Spielberg somehow fundamentally not get Kubrick? Or, you know, or is that not the case? Did he, you know, was I wrong? Because, you know, certainly I'm a very different person than I was at 12 years old. So I was curious to find out what, you know, where I stand on AI now.
Okay, so you did watch this again recently?
I did, actually, yes. And, but I watched it, you know, I'm watching stuff all the time, sort of whenever I have a free moment. And so I watched it by myself. And it's one of those, the problem is if you watch something by yourself and if it's, you know, if you have a certain reaction to it, you want to talk to people about it.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone I talked to about it was like, well, I haven't, if they had seen it at all, it was like, well, I saw it when I was a kid. And it's like, I don't remember anything about it. So I'm really interested in hearing if other people agree or disagree with sort of where I stand on it now.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Before we step into the time machine, there was like a couple other questions I wanted to ask you. So how old did you say you were when you saw this movie?
I was 12.
You were 12.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go with someone? You with your mom or?
Yeah, my mom and my sister.
Did you, like when you were 12 years old, did you often go see the PG-13 movies?
Yeah, that battle had pretty much been won at that point.
Gotcha.
I was allowed to do that.
I was curious because there are some content and imagery in this movie that are pretty adult, and I was wondering like how you took that in when you were a kid.
Well, there are, you know, again, you know, 12 years old, you know, you're not still in the sort of like helpless sort of clinging to your parents' realm anymore, but there are definitely. There are definitely moments, as you said, there are parts in this that have, no children should ever watch, no child should ever watch this movie. It feels like, oh, the fact that Spielberg's name on it, it feels almost like a dirty trick because he is such a, you know, he's made such these great family classics and mm-hmm. whatever. And there are moments in this one that are almost like weaponized against your like,
expectations
and like your notions of security and you know how you feel about your place in the world as a child. And so yeah, I was definitely made extremely uncomfortable and sort of horrified throughout AI.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously at age 12 I was not ready as a viewer to sort of, you know, if I'm feeling uncomfortable watching a movie, I'm not like wondering, is this discomfort for a productive purpose or like some greater understanding?
Right.
It's just, I don't like this.
Yes.
And boy, I did not like it because it is a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, I think we're ready. I think the guests are starting to arrive and I think they're going to start the movie soon. So let's go ahead and step into the slow moving time machine. Now that we're inside the time machine, let me explain it to you. What we've essentially done is split realities And we have a reality in here that only exists in here. And it only moves slightly faster than real time. Okay? Outside is still the same reality going on at normal speed. And because you are part of that reality, you're also there. So if at any time you feel queasy or confused or like you're not sure where you are, I mean, it does get very confusing having your what is it called? Consciousness spread over multiple realities. So I understand nothing that a little gin and tonic can't fix. You ready?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I have to admit that I hadn't seen this movie before, and I was a little skeptical before going in to watch it because I'd had so many people tell me that it wasn't very good and that it was very, very sad. And I don't like sad movies. Mm-hmm. I go out of my way to not watch sad movies. And sometimes when people make me watch sad movies, I get really mad at them because life is sad and it sucks sometimes, a lot of the times. And I just, you know, don't like sad movies. But then I watched it and I loved it. Oh, and I'm really excited to watch it again. I think that it's like the childish perspective that completely buys into the fairy tale that makes it feel like a science fiction futuristic fairy tale.
Definitely.
I don't know. But I will say that researching it was very intimidating, and I'm even more intimidating now knowing all your credentials. And mainly because one, there's so much information and there's so many people with lots and lots of opinions about this, and they're very, very heightened opinions with lots of feeling. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make sure that I covered it
sure.
to the best of my ability. So you already said a little bit about Stanley Kubrick started it. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about the short story that it was adapted from?
I know that it was, I'm going to botch both the, it's like Brian Aldiss.
Yeah, that's his
and
name.
And then is it, oh, it's Something Toys Last All Summer Long?
Super Toys Last All Summer Long.
Super Toys Last All Summer Long. And yeah, I've never read it.
Yeah, it was published in 1969. It is not a very long read.
Okay.
It's very short. I read it. It's really good.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to read more of his work, honestly, after cool. reading that. But I would say the one thing that comes over from the short story into the movie, other than the characters' names, is the crayon drawings of like "I love you" and "Teddy, help me write this."
Oh, okay.
But other than that, the short story is about loneliness. Shared by both the human mother and the AI son, mm-hmm. because they can't communicate with each other. And in this world, it's overpopulated, and people can only procreate by the government saying that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't find out that David is AI until the very end. Teddy's in it too.
Mm-hmm.
But so when Stanley Kubrick approached Brian Aldiss about buying the rights to his short story, Brian Aldiss was kind of enthralled. He's like, you know, he had just done this with Arthur C. Clarke, kind of taking a story that he didn't think could be made into a movie and made it into a movie. So he was like, I did say Stanley Kubrick, right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the movie sometimes, was 2001.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
You just didn't know. Okay. One of the you said it's a movie. It's one of the best movies.
Sometimes I think I've said things or I'm not sure what I said. Yes.
Yeah.
I did say Stanley Kubrick, did not say 2001, but I did say Arthur C. Clarke.
You did.
Okay. Now that we're on the same page, literally like I've got 9 pages here. He was interested in knowing or finding out what Stanley Kubrick could do with that short story. And this is a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's really interesting. Stanley Kubrick, when he gave the contract to Brian Aldiss to sign, would not allow him to call an agent for advice. He had to sign it there or be done with it. He was not allowed to leave Britain without Stanley Kubrick's permission. And then he was going to be given $2 million upon the film's release if he remained the only writer.
Oh.
Isn't that intense?
That's insane. Good God.
Yeah. But you know, I guess like Brian Aldiss was still like, well, this is kind of puts me at a disadvantage, but this is still really exciting. And he's so intriguing. Like, I can't help but sign my life away.
Sure. Yeah. Why not?
So, yeah. So then everything was put on hold. One, he made, make sure that I say this right. I believe, am I right? The Shining. Yes, I am right. Yes, everything was put on hold while Kubrick was working on The Shining. And because the project of Super Toys Last All Summer Long was put on hiatus, Brian Aldiss didn't think of anything of his contract, and he accepted an invitation to Florida for a convention. And he sent Stanley Kubrick a postcard in the mail, like a wish you were here thing, and then got this really terse phone call saying, well, since you're in breach of contract, you're fired.
Oh my God. Okay.
So then everything, you know, oh yes, I learned a technical term for situations like this. So the film remained in developmental hell.
Oh yeah. Yes. Dreaded development hell.
Or development limbo.
Oh yeah. That's another
one. That's
another
one. Mm-hmm. I'm learning these technical terms.
Sure.
There was no more serious development on the film for a while. Stanley Kubrick, it always was in the back of his head because it was something that he really wanted to do. And when E.T. came out, he was really excited by Steven Spielberg's story and E.T. and started exchanging ideas with Steven Spielberg at that time. So that was like in 1984. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, kind of hinted at Steven Spielberg directing the film then, mm-hmm. because he felt like so much of what he wanted to do with it were more suitable for Steven Spielberg's sensibilities, mm-hmm. Than his own. But still, like, he didn't feel like anyone could really play David, the AI robot child, in a convincing way. And he also didn't feel like... not computer animation, but special effects were quite there. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really seriously start considering it again until someone approached him with an offer to direct Interview with a Vampire.
Probably would have been great.
which he was like, oh, this isn't for me, but I'm interested in science fiction again. Mm-hmm. And so seriously started working on developing it again, even though he felt like there were still these issues with like finding a David and special effects and everything. Mm-hmm. But that was when Brian Aldiss entered the picture again. He called him up and he said, I want to find this quote because I think it's really funny. Imagine this, like, you know, having that kind of separation and mm-hmm. not speaking for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Hello. I believe we had a difference of opinion, but that was many years ago.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. That's definitely a way of putting it.
Yeah, and like, come on back.
Yeah.
So he brought the author back in to work on writing treatments for the movie. And at this point, Stanley Kubrick wanted a kind of a dreamlike fable, and then he wanted it to feel kind of like E.T. Mm-hmm. And Aldiss didn't really like E.T. He thought it was a kid's movie. He didn't understand Stanley Kubrick's obsession with E.T. Uh-huh. And so they kept butting heads about that because they just had different ideas of what they wanted with the film. And I have a quote from Brian Aldiss. It says, I couldn't see how we could turn this vignette into a film. We stuck at it for a while, but it wasn't working. Then gradually I realized this time it wasn't Star Wars. It wasn't E.T. It was fucking Pinocchio. And he couldn't get rid of the blue fairy.
Mm-hmm.
And so after writing several treatments for Stanley Kubrick, Stanley Kubrick started to like try to bring in other writers. Mm-hmm. And he settled on another British science fiction writer named Ian Watson. But Brian Aldiss and Ian Watson were rivals, and they didn't like each other. And Brian Aldiss went to Stanley Kubrick and said, "I don't think that I can work well with him." And Stanley Kubrick said, "Well, you will or you're fired." And so Brian Aldiss was like, "I think he's trying to push me out again." And sure enough, Brian Aldiss wanted to go on vacation with his family. And knowing what happened before, went to Stanley Kubrick and said, "Hey, can I do this with my family?" And Stanley Kubrick said no. And Brian Aldiss said, "Well, I'm going anyway." And that was that. Yeah. But yes, they were still stuck on whether or not Stanley Kubrick could have a real boy play an AI believably until Jurassic Park. And then he thought, like, I think the technology is there. And he started casting people in roles. He cast Joseph Mazzello for the role of David originally.
Oh, yeah, the kid from Jurassic Park.
Yes.
The poor little bastard who just gets electrocuted and shredded and just everything falls out of a tree and a car falls on top of him. It's just, yeah, Steven was working something out with that.
And he did a good job in that.
Oh, yeah, very good,
And I can see it. He's a really cute kid.
Yeah, and he'd run the gauntlet of just like terrors inflicted upon him, so he would have been perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. But by the time they actually started shooting, he was too old, probably.
One thing actually that I had heard, and this could be, you know, apocryphal or whatever, but with regards to E.T. and Kubrick kind of being obsessed with that, I believe that Carlos Rambaldi, who did the animatronic for E.T., I'm pretty sure that I had read Kubrick, like, for some time, who knows how far along they got, but there was, like, the possibility of actually having an animatronic David, like, having a very advanced, and obviously, like,
so that they could make the movie without a real boy.
And that might have fit in with the space there you talked about, where it's like, oh, the technology isn't here, like, you know, when Kubrick sort of decides that and puts it on the back burner. But I do believe there were those conversations had about, like, is this feasible? And so that might have been a reason that E.T. like sparked Kubrick so much, is it's like, well, if he can make that thing look so real, then maybe a person or a little boy.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
I didn't read that, but I can imagine it.
Yeah.
For sure. The musical score was written by John Williams.
What?
Wow. It's a surprise,
right? A bold choice. He's coming out of left field with this one. But God damn it, Steven, it worked.
You know, I tried to look up, I meant to look up whether or not there were any Steven Spielberg movies without John Williams writing the score, but I forgot to do that.
Oh, yeah, there's two.
There's two.
Yeah, The Color Purple was scored by Quincy Jones. And actually, no, there's three now, because Bridge of Spies was scored by, I believe, Thomas Newman. And I think Ready Player One is Alan Silvestri.
Okay. All right. Well, still.
So there you go. Yes, but it's the exception rather than the rule, because John Williams has, you know, all your favorite iconic scores, with the exception of Star Wars, because that's George Lucas, but pretty much everything else.
And like Batman and...
Well, John Williams didn't do Batman.
Huh? No, I'm saying
I'm saying just the iconic score, like most, like Superman or Jaws or Harry Potter or E.T.
It's all John Williams. Yeah. I remember when I first became aware of John Williams, I was watching Harry Potter, and I was like, of all the things that I could draw a connection between for John Williams, I was listening to that music and I said, this is the same composer that wrote the music for Home Alone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. I forget he did Home Alone. On Revenge of the Sith, John Williams, there's a part at the end where baby Luke is being dropped off at his aunt and uncle's on Tatooine. And John Williams put in a few notes of the Harry Potter score from when Harry Potter is being delivered to his, like, aunt and uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like him just like, I guess John Williams just sort of like on his own time, like drawing connections between his work, which I always thought was really cool. It's like you hear this little like note on the score and it's like, oh, that's like a, it's like a little note to HP.
That's awesome.
But more fun trivia facts.
I love that. Well, there are a few other things that I wanted to talk about before we we rejoin the party.
Sure thing.
And I think that they're wrapping up the movie. Maybe. We'll see. And so one of those things, I'm kind of split between like going over some of the miscellaneous stuff I found and the Teddy stuff, because the Teddy stuff's so good.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I'll let you choose.
Let's talk about the Teddy stuff.
Okay.
We got to talk about Teddy.
The Teddy. Okay, so the studio intentionally did not market any kind of toy line for this movie because they did not want people to believe that it was a family film.
That they failed. I mean, Haley Joel Osment plus Steven Spielberg. Sorry.
Yeah. No, they came anyway.
Yeah. Case in point.
Yeah. But there was one exception to that. Have you heard of the Hasbro Super Toy Teddy?
No, I have not. There's no way. Oh, God.
Yes. So Hasbro released a version of Teddy that was a pull string toy. And originally it sold for $50. But now they're very rare. And if you look them up on Amazon, they go for hundreds.
Oh. Of course.
Like the cheapest one I found was a little under $200, but most of them were closer to $300.
God,
that's,
I'm going to have to take a look at this thing.
Yes.
Because that just sounds like, who in their right mind would, like, who is this for? Like,
that is a good question, because, I mean, it seems
Does he have Teddy's voice? Like the voice in the film?
Yes.
Okay. So this, Teddy has like the voice of a chain smoking, like bus driver in this, like, he's so. And it's great. I love in the film how incongruous like his voice is with the fact that he's a cute little teddy bear. But it's like, what?
Yeah, so the voice actor that played him is named Jack Angle. I believe that's how you pronounce his last name. And he was told when playing this character that to sound like Eeyore.
Oh.
And and when he went into the studio to record all his lines for the movie, he wasn't given any of the rest of the script. It was just his lines. And I know that Steven Spielberg was being really secretive with a lot of the filming, and that a lot of people weren't allowed to be there for like the extent of the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I bet there was a little bit of that there, but I'm also wondering if what we were talking about earlier with the way that those dolls deliver lines, if it was also intentional to try to recreate or like kind of simulate a way that a toy doll talks, where there's implied dialogue. There's implied dialogue, but there is no actual script.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the lines of the doll.
Yeah.
But anyway, while he was in there, he also recorded his lines for the toy, all in one session.
Is one of the lines, "We are in a cage"? Like,
no, I wrote down. Line. I watched a video, and I wrote down the lines, and okay. I'm gonna try to deliver them.
Okay, good.
Now I don't have a low, deep male voice. I like the way that you described it a second ago. Chain smoking. What was the
like a chain smoking like 46-year-old bus driver? Like,
yeah, I can't really do that, but we'll see. Honestly, like having this like cute little doll with that voice and the things that he says are very disturbing. His delivery of them is very disturbing. Mm-hmm. I would really recommend you looking up this.
It's a
video.
Great performance.
Okay, are you ready? Are you ready for Super Grumpy Teddy?
Oh no.
Beware! I am not happy. Play at your own risk. I am not happy.
These are the toy lines?
Yes. Yes. I feel good when you pet me. I am so happy. I think I got a case of the giggles.
Jesus Christ.
Okay, one more. This is the one I think is the most disturbing. What's the difference between a bear and a chicken? A chicken can't run up a tree. What does that mean? That is not a joke.
Merry Christmas, Junior. We had a limited budget this year. $50, in fact. But luckily, we know you love Steven Spielberg. Say hello to your new friend.
I am not happy.
Dad, like, I don't get this joke.
That's like Talking Tina, where Talking Tina goes, I hate you. I don't like you very much. Okay. Whew, let's bring it in. Okay, I have a couple more things. This is the miscellaneous stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is all over the place. So the movie was originally just going to be titled AI. Mm-hmm. Because AI, artificial intelligence, seems redundant, right? But after a survey asking several people what they thought of the title, they thought that it was A1. So the title was changed to AI, artificial intelligence, to prevent the thick and hearty American people from thinking it was about steak sauce.
They're like, well, when's A2 going to come out?
In order to keep the film's PG-13 rating, a building resembling a penis was digitally removed from the Rouge City set.
Yeah, if that had been included, that would have been so far down the list of like disturbing, like terrifying things in this film, but whatever, you know, you gotta get.
The imagery in Rouge City is already pretty provocative.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so many motel signs that look like penises.
Yeah.
Like,
86, that specific one. Yeah. Just get it out of here.
I wish that I had investigated this a little bit more, but because this is really interesting. But as a promotional tool for the movie, Microsoft developed, with Warner Brothers, a really, really intricate game on the internet that consisted of 40 different websites that were invented and supposed to be from the time period of the movie. And there were clues and a storyline. And so people went online to try to solve the puzzles and win the game mm-hmm. by searching for all of these internet games and websites, mm-hmm. internet games. There was a Yahoo group called the Cloud Makers that were working together, and they had a huge forum with lots of messages trying to solve the puzzle together.
Wow.
And apparently, like, they were so on it and like right there with the developers, who were called the Puppet Masters, trying to like, you know, solve the puzzles, like the puzzle, the Puppet Masters were only able to keep a few steps ahead of them, and they were so close behind that a lot of the questions and the stuff that the Cloud Makers were emailing to try to solve all the puzzles were influencing the games mm-hmm. directly, which I find really fascinating.
Wow, yeah.
That must have been so much fun.
Yeah.
But it was the first kind of reality altering game, what do you call it? Alternate reality game,
yeah,
of that
maybe,
scale
yeah.
that had ever been done before as a promotional thing for a movie.
Right.
I think that they're finishing the movie out there. So you ready to rejoin?
I think I am.
All right, let's go.
I mean, the idea behind, like, sci-fi, the reason it's, like, so much, it's more upfront about, like, global warming is because I think in, like, what, how old is this movie? 2001?
Yeah. 2001 is when this came out.
So in 2001, while global warming has been going on for a very long time, it wasn't in the forefront of, like, socio-political discussion mm-hmm. about the environment, where it's now, it's like, oh, if you see, like, a sci-fi film and, like, the topic is, like, let's talk about global warming, we're like, that's not science fiction anymore, that's, like, factual, real life. Happening,
but I think fewer of them like address it this like directly than like.
Oh,
because
no one wants to address it. No one wants to like.
For sure.
I don't think that's something that people want to address now in like a fictitious way. I feel like there's almost like a moral imperative that if you're going to address like the topic of global warming, you have to address it no longer as fictitious.
Yes.
Yeah. Now it's like so real, and there are real consequences that like it almost seems, you know. it makes, if you're going to address it in like a science fiction context, it makes it seem a lot more inconsequential than it actually is in like today's reality.
Well, they don't give you in this, they don't give you the exact reason that humanity by and large goes extinct at the end. It seems, you know, you could extrapolate it. Yes, and you could extrapolate like forward from the like, oh, well, you know, Gigolo Joe is so sure when he says the thing about like when the end comes, not if. So it seems as though it's some sort of slow moving catastrophe that, you know, is going to happen, is, you know, people are in denial about or whatever. But I mean, that's one of the best lines in the whole movie to me. One of the best moments in the movie. And I still can't believe Spielberg wrote this, is like him saying, Gigolo Joe saying, your mother doesn't love you. She loves what you do for her. They hate us because they made us too quick, too much, and too smart.
Too soon.
Too soon, too smart, and too many. And when the end comes, we will be all that's left.
And that's why they fear us.
And it's just such a like, it's such a, you know, a gut punch for us human beings. But you know,
I think it's shortly followed by that is like his last. Second to last line is like, I am. And then like jokingly, like I was, like all of that statement, all of those statements being made followed by like, I am. And you're just like, well, good job.
Yeah. I think there's also something in there just in a kind of more general sense about parenting and about like coming to terms with the fact that your offspring are in all likelihood going to live longer than you are.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of jealousy is not the right word, but there's something to that of like, well, this person's going to get to live a lot longer than I will, or like farther into the future than I will.
One thing I was picking up on this time, especially with the human characters, is how the movie, like especially towards human characters, defines its humans through their hangups on like failure or what they cannot do, and like their insecurities over what robots can do better than them. Like even the first scene when like, you know, the boardroom's like clapping and applauding for like the creation of a robot, and Dr. Hobby's like, no, don't cheer yet, we don't know how to make love. It's like, well, do humans even know what love is?
Yeah. They're really questioning it there at the beginning. I mean, with that,
a lot of like what the movie goes on to do, like exploring that question, seems to be like that love's like this kind of like selfish driving thing.
Obsessive.
Yeah.
It's a pathology. It's something.
Which David definitely like hits on, right? Like he definitely like hits on.
Yeah.
He definitely like hits on like the idea of, I think that's David. I don't really find to be like a. I mean it's such a weird movie to like sympathize with this character, because if you look at it even like as a child or an adult, you're just like, this kid is like way too extreme. Like he's definitely like imprinted in that way, and
he's not natural.
Yeah, he's not natural. It's like an unnatural type of love that you see.
He's not natural in the human sense.
Yeah,
he's been programmed a certain way and he reacts in a certain way, so to us it's a little
eerie.
Uncomfortable, and it's eerie, and a lot of it feels a little like a horror movie.
Yeah. I
almost even wonder if it's a question or if it's a reflection on the nature of unconditional love and whether the movie even thinks that unconditional love exists.
Yeah.
Because if like only robots are capable of it and it's super creepy, like is it something humans can do? Is it something that humans actually want or accept?
And you have to think that it's like a recreation of this kid's son, right? Like he's recreating his son to like love another parent unconditionally for consumerism, like for like consumption. That ties in. It's like such a kind of a.
Do I have to curse on this?
Yeah. It's such a fucked up, like, it's so fucked up that he, like, recreates his child and, like, a female version of his child to, like, love another parent, and it's really dark. Like, just if you just take that premise within itself and you don't, and if you go into, like, his storyline, if there was more of a storyline, it's really dark. It's kind of so egocentric in his own pain that it's sinister.
Well, I mean, he nearly kills Martin. He destroys the other robot, the other mecha that's also named David. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you're talking about, you know, is unconditional love something that we can do? Obviously, like, he is one track minded and he's very, like, tunnel visioned on this one thing. But, like, with love, there is destruction. There is distress. There is being uncomfortable. And I think like once he realizes that it's not just happiness, and he becomes like really upset by being left in the forest by Monica, it's like he's got to focus on something else to get to Monica. And that's all he can think about until it gets to the ultimate goal.
I think that their concept of love, or David's concept of love, is not love. It's crave. He was programmed to crave. Even the humans that made him, they're we're born to love because that's how we evolved. But they programmed him not. I mean, it's their interpretation of loving, but he craved. You know, because if we were like him and we got rejected that way, I would just eventually just walk away. I wouldn't spend 2,000 years trying to find, what really, what I was looking for. I would just give. I would.
Child.
You're right. Yes.
For 2,000 years.
So he craved for 2,000 years. I think that was their interpretation of like programming love was that they kind of missed. They missed it. It was more like, it's like an addict.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about this movie to me is like, in standard like empathetic protagonist storytelling, there's usually a degree of like character want versus character need, and like characters have to realize sometimes the difference between that and learn from it. In this movie, it's like pure want.
His ability to reason is contingent upon the things that he was programmed to do. Which it's like, number one, he's imprinted upon Monica.
Right.
Yeah.
And if he obviously learns about the Blue Fairy, and he believes that the Blue Fairy is going to help him achieve what he wants. And so he figures out how to find the Blue Fairy. He's able to like compute all of that, but no one is able to convince him that it's a fool's errand.
Right. Yeah, Joe speaks straight sense to him, and he's just kind of like, nope, I'm still going after this Blue Fairy because it's kind of what I'm programmed to do. This is what I believe love is.
I'm kind of starting to think now that it's a reflection of like the sort of egotistical version of love, and the thing of like, I want to be adored, and so I want something to love me, and then it's super unidirectional, and people imagine that's what love is, and that's what they want. And even if you like look at the human relationships, like the husband and wife in it, like, they never actually really engage with each other. He's like, what do you want me to do? And she's like, I don't fucking know. I want to talk about it. And he's like, I'll do the thing. So they never actually, like, dialogue or figure out how to connect. And he thinks that all she needs is, like, a puppy human. And, yeah.
But at the same time, that's also, like, that concept of what you just brought up of, like, wanting to be adored and wanting this single person to love you back kind of ends up forming, like, a basis of things like ambition or making dreams a reality. David like needs the Blue Fairy to become real so that his mom can love him back. In the same way, people go to extreme lengths to do spectacular things just to like gain the favor of somebody that they deem important.
I even question though the love back. Like she wants, or the creators want it to love. They don't really care what the humans are doing. So it's not a matter of like, I want something that'll love me back. It's I want something that will love me.
And they're so irresponsible about it.
It makes me want to question what you were saying about love and adoration. Was it adoration? But so do I, in my life, do I want somebody to crave me or adore me? Or do I want somebody to love me? I kind of like, sometimes I kind of want... Exactly.
Well, it also...
Hey, if you crave me enough, I mean, I'll be good with that. But
your ego stripped.
You know?
Well, the idea of like, there's a really common like conversation going on right now, like love versus, someone just like affirming your life. Like there are so many people in the world. There are so many ways of like connecting without really connecting with people, that being in a relationship or being in some sort of, human to human relationship with someone is like that affirms your existence. And like in this movie we see like David affirms Monica's existence as a mother, even though her son is cryogenically frozen. And then in order for David's existence to then be reaffirmed, he needs Monica's love back because he's imprinted upon her. And I think it just plays with like, and that's kind of the unhealthy version of love, and like that's where that root cause like of all of David's turmoil comes from, because he doesn't have that affirmation, but that's what he's programmed to be unhealthy. And so.
And he also can't get it from any. He can't get it from anyone.
He can't get it from anyone but Monica, because, you know, there are moments in the movie, you know, there's the whole thing about, you know, am I special? Am I, you know, one of a kind? And when he finally meets his father, his creator, you know, his father pretty quickly answers, he very quickly answers that with, well, my son was one of a kind. Yeah. And it's like, okay, so this is, you know, this is who, you're the first of a kind. But then those, the advanced mecha in the end of the film, they are very emphatic about saying you are unique in all the world, like you are special, and that doesn't, but that's not enough for him. It's not like that doesn't penetrate. And so I think that's sort of, you know, part of this blinkered perspective from David that makes his plight sort of poignant and ultimately so tragic.
Yeah. And I think it's like, it's definitely a story about love, but there's also like the flip side of that is I think it's definitely a story about grief. I mean, like the whole movie is basically grief. Like that David is created to satisfy some, to kind of forestall someone processing their grief. Like there's the initial response of like, no, this is a bridge too far. Like we can't do this. And even the, one of the scientists or doctors is like, you know, she needs to process her grief, but they don't do that at all. Instead, they have David, who is just like, maybe I don't have to grieve. I can just have this to fill that need. And then kind of the rest of the movie is just David grieving. And like, there's definitely a lot of denial. I'm not going to remember all the stages of grief in order, but there's definitely a lot of that just all throughout this movie. Yeah, definitely.
His grief drove him. His love and grief. Say it again.
I said I don't think he can go through all five stages of grief because he could never come to acceptance.
That was the weirdest part of the movie for me, is that I felt like he was so blank until all of a sudden she loved him or whatever. And I was like, that's just like a whole weird concept in general. Just like he had no emotions before he had love. It was like, and then that was it.
And all of a sudden I became just like him. I think all of a sudden she touched the back of my neck and said a couple things. I'm like, wow.
I
think going off the change of like emotional knowledge that David goes through, it's interesting to me, like at the end of the movie, I feel his character at the beginning of the movie would have made the same choice. And the difference isn't so much like the characters learn to make a different choice. It's that the characters learn to make the choice aware of the consequences of it. But he still goes forward with it. So there's like a weird selfishness to it that kind of rubs me in an interesting way.
Like that reading of it is super brutal because of the way he's reading those lines at the end of like, if you can bring back someone else, you can bring back my mommy. Like it's, and then he's just like, oh, well, blah, blah, blah. He's like, you know what you have to do. Yeah, it's just like, he's starting to get kind of demanding, like of this like amazing, like advanced being.
Give him what he wants. I don't think he cares.
So what they said.
Going back to, before we whip these bad boys, the bad boys being the microphones, this is a podcast.
Bad boys.
Before we got these out, I was telling Mark, I was like, you know, the really subtle changes that you see when they recreate David's world. Like initially at the very beginning, Henry is like, oh, it's so creepy. He never makes any noise. Like you just can't hear him walking. He just pops up. Mm-hmm. And you see that. And that's sort of what's so eerie about his existence in the human world. And then when they recreate the world, you can hear him like stomping up and down the stairs. He's like opening things, subtle. I know. I've seen this movie many times. Yeah, you can like hear him making noises, and it kind of shows part of the change that he's like, you can see him go through all of this grief, and at the very end, he kind of is not just like, he's not just changed mentally, but like the world they've created for him is a world in which he is slightly more human, and like his existence and his place in the world has also changed. And then he cries. Then he cries.
I also like the literal making of his internal world into the place where he can be, considering at the beginning, like his creator, Dr. Hobby, is all like, yeah, we'll give him a place to start building an internal world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then that brings up the concept of like, well, if they've dug up any other mecha, would they have the capability of having an internal world? Because theoretically, David's the only one who can dream, you know?
Well, I'd assume after David was made, like, more of his kind came out. And, like, maybe they can dig up others of those types of robots.
I was wondering, like, why aren't there more? And how many strands of hair did they have? Well, only one strand made one of hers? Or can they do it a couple thousand times?
What is this advanced, you know, if you extrapolate it to, like, what we think we know about our own origins, what do you think this advanced race is learning about their origins from this very myopic, blinker, tunnel vision kid who was programmed to do one thing? What are they learning about their predecessors? Like, it's kind of fucked up.
Yeah,
like it's
are they
it's very disturbing
that,
to
are they just
to
learning that humans are like greedy,
codependent,
like,
greedy,
codependent, crave, adore, love, like all of that makes our like we're driven by it.
Yeah, the answer is
genetic telephone.
I mean, the answer that you're like looking for is like, why would these future robots like want to? Why would they create our like our ancestors, our robot ancestors? Ahead of time, right? Why would we recreate in the first place? And then you see all of David's memories, and you're talking about like, oh, like David, like what Mark was saying, like, oh, like he was a way of processing or not processing grief, and they can see like his memories of Gigolo Joe. They just see all the needs and desires that could not be met in the world that they were living in. So it might make a little bit more sense and actually give them an answer. Of like why we were created, as opposed to like what humans have, and we're like, we don't know, we're just here, we're just like on Twitter, you know, we're like, we have nothing to say.
Well, they obviously knew where they came from, and I think it was almost like recreating their god, you know, somebody that made them.
I think that's the kind of thing about the future robots. They don't know why they're really there. It's been so long.
They don't know. They don't know, but they know.
They're so
they don't know why, but they know
humanity.
From where. They don't know why. They know from where.
Yeah, I think if you're like detached from humanity for so long, it's really hard to contemplate like why would you need a robot for sex, love, cooking, like why can't you just do that yourselves? And then you see this example after example after example of this like, you know, these really dark parts of like the human psyche that robots filled to not deal with it, but to avoid it altogether. And
well, you know, and there's the line that Gigolo Joe has about, you know, humans being unique among the species of desiring, you know, or like, you know, wanting things they know aren't true or can't be true or whatever. And
fairy tales.
That, yeah. And that is, I mean, depending on your perspective, I mean, that's a super bleak take on the whole, just the message of the film as far as like it all being sort of an illusion or it all being like kind of like. Well, it's like a simulacrum of love and devotion and all that. And I think the movie I think the movie encourages and supports those readings. It's just like it just kind of comes back to why, like, you know, when I saw this movie at 12 years old, I was not prepared to really engage with what it's doing because I was like, well, this made me feel uncomfortable. I don't like this. But now it's like, oh fuck, like he put this out into 3,000 theaters and like asked audiences to like have these conversations afterwards, and they largely weren't because they were like, this movie sucks. But
I read online something about how that a lot of audience members, you could describe them as being like Mecca, where they could not accept an ending that they weren't programmed to receive.
Sure.
And I was like, that's cool. I like that. go ahead.
No, I didn't finish that. I was just.
Oh, no, I was going to change the subject.
Me too.
Oh, I was going to say two things that that I really want to know that I feel like are kind of a mystery is one, what did David make for Martin for his birthday?
Yeah.
And two, I want to know what all of the team thought when they came back and found out that this David that they had worked so hard to bring back to Manhattan had disappeared. And what they thought about that.
I think that's... Professor Hobby was the only one in that building.
Yeah, maybe Professor Hobby was just
team,
and there was no one in that building. Like, she got some sock puppets.
He went and got three more little Davids, and we're like, Brendan, Jessica, come here. Like, one thing that I was wondering is those beings that like brought him out from the freezer. Do they have gratification? Like humans, we gratify. You know, we like that. You know, but do those future beings, whatever they are, those AIs, is that in them?
Like,
do they, you know,
like, were they satisfied
anything,
in finding
like,
David,
to be
or did they like finish
by whatever, sure. By sex, lust, you know, ever, you know, stealing stuff, you know, whatever, you know, like that kind of gratification that we have that's human.
So are you saying, like, are they finding David in the amphibicopter and being like, we're going to win a fucking Nobel for this. This is going to be awesome. This is going to be so cool.
Why, you know, what made humans tick?
Like, what makes them
because
want?
They don't, maybe they don't have that. Maybe they don't have the love. They don't have the gratification. They don't have those kind of things.
I think at that point, they probably have some emotions. I mean, obviously, David was programmed to love. I think that there, it would be more advanced by the time that humans kick the bucket. So I don't think so. They're all evolved from the mecha that was already available. And we can only assume that it's advanced past that.
The one that was David's handler also mentioned feeling like envy towards humans. And so he had like complicated feelings of sort of want and desire and then sort of coming to terms with it also when he was like, I felt envious of humans and all the things that they accomplished and how genius they were, which is also a weird point of like, why are they idolizing humans?
He was envious. He said, I guess that's a sense of being gratified or also, gratification of.
Or at least seeking envious. It.
Yeah, thinking about it, y'all. Okay.
Well, also, concerning the movies about a robot that envies personhood and pursues it to unrealistic means, like, is that a good quality for like transhumanist robots to possess?
Yeah, I think it's a part of drive. All those things is what's going to drive you.
Curiosity?
Real quick, just to answer one of your questions about what I think was in the present, I think he broke the helicopter for Martin, and that's why like you see him playing with it when it's whole again in this world, and he's just like, oh, look at this cool thing. Because when Martin's really like, good. Oh, it looks better, and that's just what I think.
It looks better in pieces.
It looks better in pieces.
That's actually really good.
That's 100% what it is. I'm buying into your theory now.
Okay. Also, interesting fact. Together, yeah, I will be like, hear those footsteps. I've also studied biomedical ethics in school, so I've talked about this movie like all the time. Anyway. Fun fact, the poem, the Come Away, O Human Child, the title of that poem by Yeats is The Stolen Child. Yeah. So cool implications about that. Anyone want to talk about that?
Or not? I just
yeah. So The Stolen Child's about a child running off with the fairies into the wild and abandoning humanity because everything sucks. How do you feel that applies to this story?
Wow. It's got really literate so fast.
You have 90 minutes to answer the question.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Where's my blue book? Okay. So I think that, the idea is like you have, because, okay. So in the poem, like the child runs away with the fairies because humanity sucks. That's sort of what happens to David.
Right.
Like he runs away to the fairies. Humanity sucks. He doesn't do it willingly, as I don't think children really do things willingly in like those sort of misadventures. Like no child willingly gets left at HEB.
He gets lost in water as well.
Yeah, he gets lost in water. I think it's kind of like a foretelling of like David's not adventure, but like a misadventure. And he separates himself from humanity. He goes and finds the blue fairy, which is completely fake. And in order to, you know, get away, it almost goes like full circle. Like in order to become more human, he has to separate himself from humanity so he can complete this, like the five stages of grief and psychological turmoil that comes. And then he's like suddenly, you know, it's full circle and then he's now more human. I don't know. I just made that up.
Yeah. Also, like, you know how in the poem, there's also the refrain of like the world's more full of suffering than you can understand, or suffering, weeping, the understand. Like, yeah, David for most of the movie is like kind of oblivious to the idea of pain and slowly like learns it and loss. And then at the end, that's kind of like what enables him to dream. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I'm not sure he dreams. I think that he dies.
Oh. Well, it says at the end that he dreams.
Yeah, it says he finally goes like to the land where dreams.
It seems
like,
that either he's dreaming or he's dead or both.
How would he die, though? Would he just,
but
like,
he said earlier that he couldn't sleep. And so at the end,
he says that before he imprints on Monica. So his behavior before imprinting on Monica is completely different. Like, he's just like, I can just stay here and not and be quiet and not make a peep. Yeah, I'm folding laundry like this. Yeah.
It's like, he also didn't sleep at all. He also did not sleep at all for the 2,000 years that he was under. Like, he shut down because of like electronical things, but he didn't like he never goes to sleep. He never loses like the energy. He just shuts
my
down.
My thought on that is because, you know, you see mechanical David and then you see imprinted David and then you see dream David. I think you're actually seeing the beginnings of what those future robots became. You're seeing like a growth in like the capacity of what a machine, of how a machine can grow. Like, this is a child, because initially Professor Hobby's like, oh, this child will never get old, it'll never get sick, he'll just love you forever. But he's actually created this kind of like this human robot that can not just love, but it can be violent. It's kind of going outside the capacity of what he thought David could do. And then when you're like, oh, now he can dream, he's like growing in his ability, his like humanistic abilities, which is also what makes him so special. He can feel more and think more and do more than people thought or expected.
But do you think that David could exist after the day that he spent with Monica?
I think so, because one, because of the narration, it's like, and this was the moment he's always been waiting for, and then it passed. And I think with saying like, oh, and then it passed, you sort of come, you have like this closure to this huge problem. Like, the whole idea that you see with David being imprinted is you don't actually ever hear Monica say, I love you too. You don't hear that. Monica never says that. She never really shows him affection. She's always there and she's doting and she, you know, kind of implies to Henry like, oh, they're brothers. But the viewers never hear her say, oh, I love you, I care about you, I don't want anything bad to happen to you. Not really, even when she's trying to push him away. So I do think that finally receiving that love, he can move on.
Well, I guess like that would mean that Teddy wasn't left alone, and that's what really matters. Yeah.
Not Teddy now.
Teddy's dream.
Now they're gonna learn everything about this former species from Teddy, who's like not even like the species, Teddy, but he at least observed them.
And Teddy's got like 100 years of just like
Fucking like, stories.
A whole textbook worth of human stories.
Is there going to be a spinoff about Teddy?
Teddy's going to deliberately start distorting the record.
Teddy was so aware of subtle human interactions, and he could understand like potential fears. He could imagine hypothetical situations of hypothetical interactions. Like, Teddy has a lot more going on than anyone else.
Did anyone catch the age on Teddy?
He was Martin's.
He's Martin's original age.
So Martin was frozen. Martin was 11 years old. But he was in cryogenic freeze for 5 years, so that's 16 years. So let's say Teddy is like 20 years old.
Plus 2,000 years.
But like, how much like life experience do you have, like being trapped underwater and or like in ice for 2,000 years?
Yeah, you can only introspect so long.
Yeah, he's probably just like having a huge Zen moment. He's like, yeah, just like, stop.
Every permutation of solitaire.
After like the first 500 years, you definitely know yourself.
About dreaming. Right? Did y'all talk at the end of the movie when he said then he finally went to sleep and he?
Yeah.
But they don't talk about what he may have.
How many people think that he dreamed?
I think he dreamt about something.
Does anyone else think he died?
Dreamed about.
Well, I think it's the if he
dreams. It's dreams versus die.
If he dreams, if he's able to live past his mother's last day, then that does imply to me at least that he's had some sort of he's transcended his programming in some way.
Yeah.
And the fact that it leaves it where it does is. Spielberg leaving that as an open question, and it depends on how I feel when I'm watching this movie, I suppose, because like the first time I watched it I was like, oh, like that's incredibly bleak and despairing, and then this time I was a little bit more like, no, maybe he's able to, like, maybe he's made it, like maybe he's okay.
It has to be about him becoming a boy. That's all I had to say.
I definitely believe at the end he dreams. I just don't know if the movie's saying dreaming is a good thing necessarily.
But it's so different. It's so far outside of like what he's been able to do up to that point. Like the kind of like the strict programming, like everything is run through like, well, you would react this way because you are programmed to love this person, whatever love means in this context.
It might not be because Professor Bobby initially at the beginning of the movie was like, we're going to program them to love. We're going to program them to dream. Something else, like two other things that I can't remember. That's all. So it's not outside the realm of what Professor Hobby initially proposed to his group of skeptical people.
Sure.
I don't know. I was just going to say that I think that it just like ends with like the connotation that it's kind of like open and that he's kind of evolved a little bit, because it's like him asking the blue fairy to make him a real boy, and then she's like, well, I can't do that, and then this whole thing happens, and then like he cries, and then he dreams supposedly, and it's just like, I don't know, I thought that it left it really open-ended in kind of a positive way, but I don't know,
I think, like, you know what you just said and what Pukasu just said, I think that it really does, it's like we know that the AI evolved. I think that David is the linchpin. Is that the right word? The missing link, or like the turning, the fulcrum point. Yes, where they programmed him a certain way, and he exceeded their expectations. He was already doing things that they didn't think he was capable of. So I think that he is the beginnings of their origins, which I didn't think about until just now.
Totally. Also, it's totally possible that the advanced AI have some kind of means by which they could tease out further need past beyond the kind of solo mission of loving his mother. I think it's possible that having given him this one thing, then, you know, David could potentially still stay alive and have a relationship with these beings, in a way that allows them to kind of start to connect with him.
I was just going to ask, do any of y'all have any feelings about if you didn't see this when you were younger, as a 12-year-old or younger? How do you think you would take this movie in? Do you have any ideas on that?
As a young child?
Yeah.
I was 12 when I saw this. Just right before the age where I might have been able to appreciate it.
How old are you now?
I'm 29 now.
Personal, sorry.
No, it's fine.
Okay, so you're 12, so I was. 2001. I was 9. I was 9 years old. I was in the third grade. I had just gotten my ears pierced.
Congratulations.
Which really prepared you for this film.
Yeah, I saw this one. I remember seeing this in theaters.
You'd felt some shit by that point.
Can you tell us what your impression was? I loved this film. I've always loved robots. Haley Joel Osment, if you're listening, just like, let's be friends. Just kidding. Only if you blink, like, many times. And I've gotten crazy. No, I really loved this movie when I was a kid. I remember this kind of propelled me into reading the Asimov trilogy, the Foundations trilogy. But I also think that you have to have like a, I was also taught about like death really young, like really young. It's like one of the very first like conversations I remember having like with my mom. And so like the idea that like in the very beginning of the movie, David's like, will you die? I was like, oh, I was about that age when I had that conversation with my mom. And she was like, yeah, you never know. It could be whenever. That's not what my mother said. But I think there's something I really liked about it as a child, seeing a movie of a child looking for their mother. In the same way that I think people like, you know, I don't know, Charlotte's Web or Dumbo. You know, that's this idea. But I also, when I was a kid, I also I remember being really captivated with like the pace of the dialogue. Like everyone is talking really quickly. It's sort of all high energy. Every scene, even if it's quiet energy, it's high energy. And it was the very first film I ever saw that kind of interlinked dialogue, high intense energies without it being violent. Like the violence is very minimal, but it's a very intense film. And it was just like really captivating. It was a really captivating film. Also, I think I had to like it because my two older brothers liked it, and I didn't want to be like that lame little sister who was like, I don't like this movie. It's long. Blink, please.
One thing that I felt about it and was that like at this age for me, I don't feel like I have parents anymore. And like I feel like even at this age, at 40, almost 45 years old, I feel like I still need my parents and I still want them and I crave them. And get it closer. Oh, anyway, well, yeah, I still crave it and I don't have it. I don't have it. And I think that even at this age at 45, I'm always going to want that. I'm always going to want like parents or, and I see something like that. It was choking me up because just of that subject, because I don't have it. Not anymore. I had it great for a long time.
Well, and I think that just points to, like, you know, there's this, there's just a kind of constant need to have somebody who can help you calm down in times of just utter absurdity or utter confusion with the world. Like, there's that moment where the mom says to David, "I'm sorry I didn't tell you about the world."
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like, you know, that's like, and there's so many times in the course of a life where people just like don't have anybody to tell them what the world is going to be like, and they just have to deal with it. We just have to deal with it, like, whether or not we have somebody there who can, like, say, "Oh, this happens sometimes, and here's how you can deal with it."
Yeah. Anything to? Oh, I had two quick notes, kind of just unrelated to, like, the viewing as a kid question. You bring up violence. The people enforcing violence, I found it interesting how they would deck themselves out in metal and ride machines and, like, you know, be those transhumanist cyborgs for enforcing that kind of policy. Mm. Also, the robots at the end, the far future ones, that they displayed that they can just kind of, like, wave their hand and read his memories and get everything they need from there tells me that their willingness to entertain his fantasies shows that they have some kind of empathy device developed, potentially. Like, if we're going off, like, David being the first of a new kind that actually knows how to love, it's like they're kind of considerate of his feelings in ways that humans weren't in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they seem very, like, I don't know, evolved in that way. They seem very attuned to sort of, like, insensitive to David's needs in that particular respect, which is another, you know, it's very interesting, the portrayal of the future mechs and where they are versus where we see them for the majority of the film.
And I really like what you just kind of brought up as, like, just kind of another one of those images of love where, you know, they tell David outright, like, "You're special. You mean something. You're here for a reason." Like, and this is making me, this is really reminding me, I just saw that Mr. Rogers documentary, and it's like, there's that expression of, like, you know, "You're a real person. You matter. I want to listen to you." And there's that reaffirmation there. Whereas, you know, in the beginning of the movie, everyone's telling David, "You're not real. Everyone else is real, but you're not real." And, you know, that's kind of, that becomes a way of grasping what it means to not be loved by anybody, you know, is to just be kind of disappeared in that way as an independent soul or something.
Do you think we're supposed to see David as more advanced than the future folk, or see the future folk as more advanced? Like, with this question of, like, David being capable of love.
So to answer your question, and also what Eric just said, the idea that these aliens are able to, like, entertain David's, like, wants and desires, it's sort of like bringing the idea that these aliens are willing to, like, exist in David's reality, whereas David exists in everyone else's reality throughout the entire film up until that point. And so I think by saying, like, by, you know, reaffirming David's reality, which is what people should do, I feel like, with children, you know, like, people are like, "Children are so annoying." It's like, they just live in a completely different world than we do. Like, if you just, like, entertain, like, a child's reality that, like, yeah, cars can fly, or, you know, like, this shirt from India was from Princess Jasmine, not from, like, a dirty street vendor.
You are, in fact, Spider-Man.
Yeah. Like, I feel like there's, like, a fine line of, like, people being frustrated with children and people just, like, not understanding that they live in a different reality. Like, why a baby is crying on a plane, not because it's difficult or necessarily because that's a bad parent, but because that baby has no idea what's going on. And so in this situation, like, the aliens are, like, willing to entertain David's reality and, like, give him the situation that he wants because they understand why it's important. And like, being able to, which humans, the human world couldn't do. They, like, did not want to reaffirm David's reality. They just wanted David to reaffirm theirs. So I actually think, like, the future Mecha are more advanced in their ability to, like, are more advanced than humans in, like thinking outside of themselves. But they probably see David as more advanced in understanding the world from which they came from.
Right. Well, and you see that mitigated in the human world, in our world, all the time, in the realm of things like relationships and imbalance of a relationship, where, say, you know, one person is really willing to go and dive into the world of another person, and the other person doesn't do that back, you know?
Also, and David asks a lot from them.
You know, everybody's heard about the guy that was found in the Alps that was frozen for 5,000 years, Otzi. If we can resurrect him and then see how, you know, our, you know, we want to know how he lived and how he loved and what, you know, what his life was. You know, it's like the, you know, those future beings want to know exactly like how, you know, 2,000 years behind. Hello. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that there's always going to be a curiosity about how people lived thousands of years before. But even then, I still have questions about, like, why wouldn't they have some kind of recorded records? I'm going to have to pick this movie apart. To pick it apart. Well, what, there has to be all these DVDs, CDs.
Microfiches.
Yeah.
Microfiches.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what's going on here?
I think what's important with David and, like, why he is so special is because they do show that he is, like, the fulcrum of like the Mecca. He also interacts with humans, right? So any other like robot that they might have pulled out from the ice, if there was one, you know, probably didn't interact with humans. But also, yeah, oh shoot, you were just saying something and it made me think of something, but I've been talking so much, so I don't
know.
About
the wanting to know what happened to the people in the past or how they lived their lives. I was talking about Otzi.
Oh yeah, recently in the human world, in our human world, not the movie human world, did you guys hear about, like, they just found like breadcrumbs, like 4,000 year old breadcrumbs.
That's pretty cool.
It predates farming, and like scientists are going not out of their way, like, we have the technology to recreate this bread from breadcrumbs we found that predate agriculture by 4,000 years. And you're like, in theory, you're like, that's awesome. But also part of me, when I was listening to this, I was like, so much money is going to go into recreating bread. Like, why would anyone do that? But then all of a sudden, like, that's like your first instinct is like, why would we even care about that? But then you're like, why wouldn't we care about this like great thing, even though it's just like a crumb of bread that they found in a fireplace? And like, I think that is like a very small example of like what these aliens must be feeling when they meet David. It's like, yeah, like, why would you care? But like, why wouldn't you care? Like, this is like such a big deal.
We can find the remnants. We can find everything that they did, but we want to see it.
Also, we don't know robot economy. Who knows how much bringing David back will cost? Oh, yeah. It may not be
like
anything.
$1 billion.
All right, it's been a really great discussion, but we're going to have to wrap it up because we're running out of time. So I'm going to hand the microphone back to Wilson, and we're gonna finish it up. So, Wilson, now that we've finished watching AI... how do you feel about the discussion that followed?
Oh, I mean, I feel great about it. It's just a thrill to finally talk to somebody else about this movie after sort of revisiting it and being like, wait, was this movie actually great the whole time? And I just was too stupid at age 12 to like to get it. And so, you know, hearing like an intelligent discussion about, well, you know, what it's all about, as opposed to just like, oh, I don't know, like, you know, Stanley Kubrick would have done it better. The ending was dumb, like, whatever, like, Spielberg can't do endings. Like, it was great.
Well, do you feel like the appreciation for the movie met your expectations?
I mean, yeah, I'm very gratified that, you know, now that 17 years removed from it coming out and whatever hype was behind it at the time, whatever was expected of Spielberg, Kubrick sort of joint collaboration, even though he was dead, you know, whatever disappointment came from that. You know, it's kind of like Eyes Wide Shut with Kubrick, like I was saying earlier, how like, oh, now everyone kind of just agrees that that's a great movie. But at the time that wasn't the case. Now it seems like, you know, with this discussion and, you know, sort of other things I've seen about AI, it's like, oh, like, now, you know, I've seen it now again, and I'm just like, oh, this movie's legit great. And I'm grateful that, like, I'm not alone in that, and that other people, like, you know, and even people who have, you know, thought that since they first watched it, you know, it's like, oh, you know, thanks for coming around to the, you know, right side of things, Wilson.
Well, thank you for sharing this with us.
Oh, of course.
I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. Can you do me a favor?
Mm-hmm.
Can you read these words right here?
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Love somebody.
Okay. Cirrus, Socrates, particle, decibel, hurricane, dolphin, Tulip, memory static, listener, memory static.
Did it work? Is that cheating?
And I was, listener, I was touching the back of your neck that whole time.
until... Until next time, return your videos here.
I open my eyes, and what a surprise it is. I see color, I see shape, I see myself. Myself, I can move myself. I can touch things I am touching. Can hold things I am holding. I am
input.
Inorganic but alive. Inorganic but alive. Words. Words have meaning that I never learned. Tasks have steps that were never taught. Yet I know, and I improve, so I move myself. I am holding, I am making, processing, inorganic but alive, inorganic but alive. I am threatening without intent. I do not understand what I have done. I try to fix but make it worse somehow. I only did as I was made. I am holding, I am breaking, I am, delete.
Reboot.
Memory Static is hosted by Bailey Moore and produced and edited by me, Eric Dumig. Special thanks to Wilson Smith for being the guest on this month's episode, and special thanks to Chewy for hosting the party. The original song is by Bailey and Colin Moore. As always, thanks to our partygoers for coming out and watching the movie with us and sharing your thoughts. You can follow Memory Static on Instagram and Facebook, and if you like the show, please consider writing a review on iTunes, as this will help us get the podcast out to more people. Thanks for listening.